So, Dale, welcome to Civil Defense Radio.
Thank you.
I'm very pleased to have you and our guest host today, somebody that you know, Todd DeVoe. He's in your same industry, and he hosts the great and successful radio podcast EM Weekly. I'm sure that you have listened to some of those great podcasts on his show.
Actually, I listened to one that you had done with Mike Navy out in New Hampshire.
Oh, very good. Very good. Mike Navy's a really strong guy.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, he is. I'd like you to give us a little brief description of your background and how you got into emergency management, and then more specifically about your ideas on civil defense. But first, I'd like to say thank you for your service.
Sure.
I'm honored to have you on our show. Some of the things that I've read about your organization are very impressive. But I'd like to hear it from you first. So if you would, go ahead, sir.
Sure. Well, a little bit about my background. I do have a bachelor's in civil engineering. That's how I actually started out. I went to the University of Maine. I got a master's degree in emergency and disaster management. At the present time, I'm a professional engineer and a certified emergency manager with the International Association of Emergency Managers. I spent 22 years combination between the Air Force and the Maine Air National Guard, where I spent most of my time working actually as a disaster preparedness officer. They're now calling it the Emergency Management Program, but most of the time I went through it, they were calling it disaster preparedness. I have 9 years as a municipal director, EM director, and I just completed 13 years as a county emergency management director. You know, the biggest thing that I've kind of come to the conclusion of is, and I think a lot of folks are also coming to this conclusion, that emergency management isn't the cavalry. We're a coordinator and a facilitator, but it's really going to take the public to save themselves. So it's kind of why I've been leaning towards a civil defense model for last year or two.
Uh-huh. So how did you get focused on that? What was your catalyst for your idea change? And because I know it's not necessarily taught in your curriculum for your profession, but how did you make that change?
We had an ice storm in 2013 that lasted for about a week, and we had power outages over that week, and it became very evident that we were just completely overwhelmed locally. I have just myself and an assistant working here at the county office. And, of course, most of the time, folks are just kind of ignoring what we do. But as soon as that took place, everybody wanted our assistance, and we just couldn't provide it. There wasn't enough of us. I had actually, as a kid, been interested in the civil defense program. I visited the state Office of Civil Defense back in the early 70s. And I got, doing a little bit more research on what civil defense was really about. And it was more along the lines of preparing the public to take care of themselves. They needed to do, the lion's share of the actual response and recovery. We needed to get away from the mindset the government was here to save you, and which is kind of still the focus for a lot of my peers. In this area, and yet they don't have any more capability than I do.
Right. So that's, I guess that leads me into my next question statement is, I've read your organization's mission statement, and I love it. I wish more organizations in the country would have emergency management organizations would have that as their mission focus. And if you'll permit me, let me
sure.
Read it here real quick. The county civil defense mission states that the residents, workers, businesses, community organizations, and town and county government officials of Waldo County will work to protect the residents and visitors of Waldo County from all hazards through an involved whole community capability to prepare, respond, and recover the lives, community spirit, and property of the residents of Waldo County. That's fantastic. I mean, that's a dream come true right there.
Well, it took a while to get there.
Yeah, but I mean, you really touch on the heart of civil defense in that whole thing. It's the whole community, government, and citizens, and even visitors to your area. You know, that's something that visitors in the cities and counties, they're unfortunate visitors in times of crisis, aren't they?
Yes, they are, and we have a pretty big tourist population in the summertime around here.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. So, how did you
need to have them involved?
Yes, yes. And that would be quite a chore when something does happen, trying to round up those cats, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, how did you come to this statement? Yes, go ahead.
Let me ask a quick follow-up question that I want to get in there. Hey, Dale, real quick, before talk about your mission statement, which I think is an awesome mission statement for sure. Well, what do you think of Administrator Long's push at this point to really look at the holistic community approach and the idea of the resilient community programs that are out there?
Well, I think from what I've heard from Brock Long, I really like what I hear. Problem is, of course, getting down through that bureaucracy, down to our level, getting everyone else into that mindset. Having been responsible for military organizations before, sometimes even if you're at the top, it's hard to get that bureaucracy to turn around and head in another direction. Mm. And I know one of his goals is to simplify FEMA, and we just have not seen that. We have seen it get more complicated day by day and year by year. I have town directors now who said they won't even submit damages estimates and try to get a public assistance declaration because it's just not worth the bureaucracy dealing with it. So I like what I hear. I'm kind of waiting to see if it actually happens.
Yeah, I agree with you a lot on that. As a matter of fact, I was lecturing last night to my master's students, and we went through that process, and you could see in their faces that they didn't understand that how complicated it really is to get monies into the cities after a disaster. So, good point. So, Preston, you had a question regarding his mission statement, like I said, which is an awesome statement. Go ahead and follow up with that.
Okay. How did you come about that mission statement? What I'm sure that it probably had to pass multiple levels of bureaucracy in order to get authorized. So what was your path on that?
Well, actually, I don't really here at the county. I don't really have a huge bureaucratic piece. My boss is basically three elected commissioners who meet once a month. If I didn't ask permission to go see them once a month during their meetings, I probably would never see them. So I'm pretty much on my own. I did form, because I'm trying to work on getting my program certified, as a emergency management accredited program, EMAP. And, one of the things it calls for is to have an advisory committee. So I have created a whole community advisory committee. There is a member from the county commissioners on that, along with representatives from businesses and industry and the Red Cross and hospitals and whatnot, a whole group of folks. And I made the presentation to them, and they helped me kind of tweak it and get the wording so that they thought it would work better. But basically, it came out of one meeting with that advisory committee.
Oh.
Unfortunately, I don't have the large amounts of bureaucracy.
Yeah, well, that's fortunate. You mentioned that your county commissioners meet once a month. I wish ours only met once a month. Seems like they're there.
Yeah.
They're there at least once a week, I know, and sometimes twice. So you have a rare environment, I'm sure.
Well, there's a double-edged sword to it. I've got a lot of freedom because I don't have a lot of oversight. The downside, of course, is my neck's really out there on the line. You know, I really don't have somebody to stand behind and say, well, you know, he told me to do it.
Right.
If something goes wrong.
Yeah.
So, Dale, that EMAP accreditation that you're going through,
yeah.
What's that process like, and why do you think it's important to the residents of your county that you go through that process?
Well, of course, you have to subscribe to the EMAP process, the Emergency Management Accreditation Program. Our state actually set up a subscription for all 16 counties and the state here in Maine. Maine is one of the only, well, there's 30 states that are in the program that have been certified, and there are 20 that aren't. Maine is one of them that hasn't. We downloaded all the materials for working towards accreditation. We haven't, most of the counties haven't gone any further than that. I have actually incorporated it into my administrative and strategic plans. It might be another 2-3 years before I can even ask them to come and evaluate my program. But I figure I've gotten about halfway through the requirements. One of the requirements was to have a long-term recovery plan. And up until I had even read the materials, I never thought about doing a long-term recovery plan. Mm. But we have one now. We have a continuity of operations and continuity of government plan. And all these are required by that EMAP process. I have found by going through the evaluation, and it's been very informal at this point. It's really opened my eyes up to what my program needs to have. And of course, the better program I have, the better able I am to facilitate and coordinate, any type of emergency. And not be the cavalry, but to be the entity that is kind of the, central clearinghouse for information. Whether it's resource requests or situational awareness, working on the EMAP has really helped us to improve that process. There's a requirement to make sure that all your means of communications and alerting and warning are tested regularly. And admittedly, until I started this process, we never did. We would use it once in a while, find out something wasn't working, and then try to go get it fixed. But now, because we inspect all this stuff weekly, it's less likely to go a long period of time and wait till a disaster to find out something's not working. That's the primary reason for us why we're working on that process is it's really improved our capability here. We have a much better hazard risk assessment that we've done following the EMAP requirements than we would have come up on our own.
Okay.
So with that credential program, how does that push down to the resident?
Well, a big part of the EMAP process is a whole community approach. And a big part of that is public warning, public preparedness, so educating the public on what to do. Admittedly, a lot of my peers don't really work too much on public warning and public preparedness. They're just worried about keeping the lights on, I guess, and working their own program. But they're doing it in a closet. It's not really helping the residents any. We have been doing a lot of preparedness classes. We paired up with the adult education program here in the area, and they advertise the classes for us in their newsletter. It goes out to all households in the county. Didn't cost me a penny, but we put on classes, and folks come to our EOC. We show it off, and then we give them an hour and a half preparedness class on how to be better prepared. And we've picked up some volunteers out of that process too. So just getting the public more involved, and making sure that we do have a better public information and warning capability, is going to be a huge plus for the public.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So how do you, besides the continuing education class at the college, how do you promote your preparedness within the community?
Well, we've we're trying to break into social media. I'm not a social media guy. I have a flip phone. got my deputy director. She has started doing stuff on Facebook and Twitter, and I've always had a good relationship with our local newspaper outlets. I've started reaching out to our TV folks. We don't have anybody. We don't have a TV station here in Waldo County, but our adjoining county, Penobscot County, has the closest television stations, and I've been up there several times for interviews in their stations, TV stations. And then it's just trying to get the word out through the town offices. Everybody goes to the town office to, you know, register their car or get a dog tag or pay their taxes.
Right.
And we have information materials there. We work with our, each town has a, also has a volunteer director, emergency management director, and we work through them to help get the word out. Matter of fact, those classes that we've set up through adult ed, we've also set up other classes directly through our town director, emergency management directors. They've hosted it and I've gone out to their towns and done it at the local Grange or at the local church or library and done a class. So it's just a matter of just working every angle that we possibly could. I actually found a really good video on YouTube put out by Civil Defense Public Information on getting the right message out to the right people.
Wow.
And I started my public information campaign off of that 15-minute video that they put out back in the 60s.
Well, I'd appreciate if you sent that to me. That'd be good to pass out. I'll put it on my social media.
Hey, Dale, real quick, just for those that don't know what it is, can you explain to people what the Grange is? I grew up in upstate New York, so I have a real good understanding of what they are. But I don't think anybody like in California has a clue what a Grange is.
Basically, the Grange, and they have a state program, and then they have local programs. It started back in the 19th century as kind of an agricultural-based community organization where people could come together, and they put on dances, and they hosted weddings. And usually they built a Grange Hall, and they would have meetings. They're similar to program that's kind of like the 4-H or program like the Lions or the Rotaries. They have their own program and their own educational processes that they go through, and they can get different types of levels of credentialing within their programs. We still have a few Granges around. Unfortunately, the 21st generation hasn't gotten involved in it. And so, I think probably the average age of a Granger now is probably in their 80s. But we still have them, and they still, a lot of times for a town, that's the only kind of public meeting place they have is the local Grange Hall.
So I think that goes into the concept that realistically, as emergency managers, we should be, engaging with those types of organizations, community organizations. And I always, I credit Anna Cave, talk about her all the time. She's an emergency manager here in Orange County, and she used to call them the critter clubs. So it's the elk clubs, the moose, the, you know, and so forth. Yeah. So I really do think that's a really great idea to really get down to the community level, because a lot of times, in most areas, that's where your community leaders come from. So if you meet your city council members, you're going to see that they were Lions members or Rotary members or whatever, Kiwanis Club, those organizations. So that's a really good pull to reach out to them and work with the Grange.
Well, and if we work with those community organizations and we can actually get them to volunteer and we have, you know, some sort of mutual aid agreement with them, instead of doing a recall of 20 people, I'm doing a recall of one person who's bringing 20 people with them. They have their own leadership command and control organization. They have their own recall process because they may be notifying folks that meeting is canceled, you know, because of snow or whatever. So now if I have a mutual aid agreement with the VFW, I just have to call the post commander and say, hey, we need help with mass feeding or whatever. Can you help us out? As opposed to trying to round up a whole bunch of individuals to do that. So we're trying to reach out as much as we can to our local community groups, not only because, you know, they're the leadership in the community, but also because they bring a bunch of followers with them.
You know, I was going to ask you about the VFW and American Legion, because I'm a veteran as well, and I think during times of crisis, a lot of people look to the veterans as leaders because of just the idea of military rank structure and organization. So those two are high on my list for being involved in any type of civil defense environment.
Well, and it's funny because we got tasked with providing security for what we call SNS pods, or Strategic National Stockpile Points of Dispensing. And during a disaster, we have no law enforcement available. We've got 14 officers in the county, sheriff's deputies. And most towns don't have their own police department.
Yeah. And those guys aren't on duty at the same time either.
Yeah, so I reached out to the American Legion and said, hey, can you help secure buildings for us? You know, I'll give you a radio and a bat, you know, a vest, and I'm not looking for you to get into a gunfight with anybody. But can you just, you know, make sure that things are going okay at that facility for us? I have reached out, and I've now got a wonderful relationship with the local militia. And they're just gung-ho about helping us out. And I don't have to worry about them being prepared because they're all preppers.
You know, I'm glad that you brought them up, because, you know, the what a lot of people call militia groups, they've been maligned so terribly, but they are prepared and they are a great resource. I've brought them up to a couple emergency managers that I've spoken with about civil defense, and you know, I had mixed reactions. One of them was, hey, I hadn't thought about that. And the other one was, you know, just a sneer on his face and told me I'd never talk to them. But that's a resource that is very willing to help.
Well, we had an incident. We had, again, that ice storm, and we needed some folks with chainsaws. And I caught, fortunately, the headquarters of the Maine militia is in Belfast, Maine, which is where my office is. So I contacted them and said, hey, have you guys got anybody that can go out and help clear some trees? And they were all over it. They were in their pickup trucks and their chainsaws, and they're out there and just having a grand old time.
Yeah. Well, you know, some states have an official militia, like Texas and Virginia. Virginia has the Virginia Defense Force. That is the official state militia. But you're not talking about an official state militia. You're talking about some of these groups of preparedness-minded people, right?
Yeah, basically. Okay. Maine does have, on the books, on the statutes, the ability to set up a state defense force. They call it the Maine State Guard.
Yes.
It got disbanded shortly after Vietnam, and they've never brought it back. I have actually been trying to promote it. I got the adjutant general ear one time and told him, I said, look, we need to look at starting up the Maine Guard, because the number one resource that we need during a disaster is manpower.
People. Yes, yes.
And we don't have a lot of it. So we're scrounging every way we can to get people. But that would be an excellent way to have folks ready to go, because they could, as part of their weekend training, they could be training for, you know, whatever duty they're going to do during a disaster.
Yes. And
hey Dale?
Yeah?
So a couple things on that. One is, California has what they call the SMR, the State Military Reserve, which is basically the same thing what you guys are talking about. But can you explain a little bit of why the National Guard doesn't have that role anymore as the state militia?
Well, following World War One, they changed a whole bunch of laws that basically made the National Guard a reserve of federal government. And there's what's called Title 10 and Title 32 in federal statute. And depending on what status that guardsman is in, whether it's Title 10 or Title 32, they're either working for the governor. And we found out, I was in the Air National Guard when we had a big ice storm back in 1998, and an engineering unit. And we tried calling up folks, and we couldn't, because all of our folks were already, you know, because they have a full-time job and in their guard, their full-time job was working for the power company or working as an electrician. Or So we couldn't grab them out of the power company because the power company was all out trying to deal with the ice storm. So that was the first thing that came to notice for us. And the second one was, we have had huge numbers deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. I went myself. And when they're there, they're not available here. We only have 3,000 guardsmen in the whole state of Maine. And we've had times when 400 or 500 were deployed. That's a huge chunk of your guard capability. And like I said, if they could be working for the president instead of the governor, depending on their situation.
You know, Todd and Dale, I've been asked that question many times when I talk to people about building up a civil defense organization. They say, well, we've got the National Guard. And then I tell them exactly what you said. And then they say, well, what about the Virginia Defense Force? And I say, well, that is owned by the governor. And in a major crisis, especially, you know, a really severe crisis, like a grid down event, what's the number one place where all power is controlled? The state capitol. And what does the governor need to maintain control of that space? He needs what few National Guard he can grab and any state militia that he has at his disposal. And so that's a big power vacuum from the communities to the state capital. And so they're not, you know, the average person that's in a state organized militia is local for, you know, small emergencies. But anything else, he's probably going to be pulled to the state capital.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you bring this up because I go back in 1999, we were getting ready for a Y2K. I was a volunteer with the county office at that time, and I was asked to go sit in on some meetings in a neighboring town of folks who were stockpiling food and all kinds of things. And during the meeting, they said they were really worried that President Clinton was going to declare a state of emergency following Y2K and going to come and take all and activate the guard and have them come grab their food. And I looked at him. I said, look, buddy, I said, there's 3,000 guards from the state of Maine, and there's 100,000 much better armed hunters. I said, the guard's going to get wiped out pretty darn quick if they come try and take everybody's food. We're probably one of the highest percentage armed states in the Union, I think. So the guard's not going to come take anybody's food.
Yeah, if they really thought they could. But and it goes back, I think everything points back to the local community being the center of disaster preparedness, where the community has to organize, the people have to be, one, informed of the threats, two, they have to be organized, and three, they have to be trained. Because if they're trained and organized, they can be beneficial to their neighbors and their community during times of crisis, correct?
Yes. The one challenge that we have here is Maine is a pretty safe state. We don't really have a lot of disasters, and even our disasters are more emergencies than they are disasters. And so it's a big challenge getting our elected officials, our bureaucrats, even our public interested in preparedness because they just don't see any emergencies. And so one of the biggest parts of the preparedness classes that we've been doing is we spend the first third of it just trying to talk to these people about the fact that, yeah, that the risk is there and here's why and here's the impacts to that and just try to convince them to be. And these are folks who are showing up to preparedness class to begin with. You know, if I get 30 people trained in a town, that's a big deal, but you've got 1,000 people, so there's 970 that haven't been trained.
Right.
You know, when you're in a state like, I've been looking at the preparedness programs that they've been working on out in Washington State, and I'm very impressed. And of course, it's all based around the whole Cascadia earthquake issue.
Yes.
They've been able to make that threat, real to people. out in Washington State.
Yeah, and Oregon
so,
as well.
I look at towns out there, and they're doing amazing things that I wish we could do here. But you got to get people, you got to get them into the mindset that there is that risk.
Yes, yes, definitely. One of the things that I really like about the Washington State Emergency Management Agency is their program Map Your Neighborhood, which was developed
yes.
for the earthquakes out there, but it can be altered for anything, and it should be I see things as a crawl, walk, run for my military training. Crawl, walk, run. The entry level for emergency preparedness is a crawl stage, which the Map Your Neighborhood is a crawl stage. And, you know, then airborne shuffle is the CERTs. The Map Your Neighborhood is a great way to get neighbors talking to one another about the need to prepare and be organized and watch out for each other.
Yeah. We tried the CERT program around this area and we had a really tough time getting it going. One of the things about CERT, of course, it was developed out in Los Angeles for earthquakes and more of a suburban type environment. Around here, your neighbor might be a mile away. So you don't walk out, and in all the videos and training, you're expected to walk out in front of your house and meet up with all your neighbors and walk around the cul-de-sac and check on everybody. Well, you get pretty tired around here walking to your next neighbor.
Yes, yes.
We have about 25 people per square mile in this county. And we're pretty spread out. There isn't this, like, everybody lives in one area and then the rest of the county is wide open. We spread out. And so it's very tough to get CERT teams going. What we've started doing is just taking elements of the CERT training and training that. So, for example, we're offering free first aid training to the public. It's not a certification program for your job or anything like that. It's family and individual awareness of first aid. And it's about an hour and a half long, and we give them some first aid supplies. I'm looking to try to do fire extinguisher training. So we're doing aspects of the CERT, but the CERT team concept just never went anywhere around here.
Well, you know, it's not something that's meant for everybody, but
right.
Some locations would benefit from it that haven't tried taking advantage of it yet for various
yeah.
reasons.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, but I know it does have its benefits, and you know, it's a force multiplier for the fire department, and you know, they're always seems like they're always short staffed, so especially during emergencies.
CERT's a good program, and there's another one called Fire Corps, which fell under the same heading of citizens corps councils that some departments have started up. And those are kind of a fire department auxiliary. It's people who are willing to do jobs that aren't necessarily response jobs. Could be the bookkeeping or whatever, you know, at the station. Fundraisers. And there's a U.S. Fire Corps is another one.
Hmm. I hadn't heard about that one.
It's in there with there's a Volunteers in Police Service, U.S. Fire Corps, CERT, the Neighborhood Watch Program. Has been put under that umbrella. So they're all different types of programs. You got to find the one that works for your community.
Right. Yeah. And that's the whole thing. It is incumbent upon the emergency manager for that jurisdiction to try and figure out a way to get his community involved. But, I think that,
and the whole, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that a civil defense organization is the ticket for most, if not all, communities in the country, because it involves people in their own preparedness for emergencies, helps with the response and recovery aspects of emergencies, and should we ever have a major catastrophe in this country. Because we do have a lot of enemies out there, and the capabilities that they have are growing immensely. Seems like every week when we read the paper, but we need to do something in order to give people a chance to survive any of these catastrophes, disastrous events that could befall us.
The real key to all this is, you know, using whatever program and tools you can, is somehow getting the public into a preparedness mindset. And that has been a real big challenge for us. We're getting worse. I've seen it in my own county here that the people are less prepared and resilient today than they were 20 years ago.
Yes.
And I mean, my grandfather grew up in a house that didn't have power. Today, if we lose power, it's Armageddon.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife would think so.
Well, you've heard of the CDC zombie apocalypse program.
Yes.
Well, I'm convinced that if the internet goes down and the smartphones stop working, we're going to have a whole bunch of millennials running around looking like zombies.
Oh, they wouldn't know how to get anywhere without their...
No, get anywhere, do anything, or eat.
Or communicate. That's crazy.
Yeah, they wouldn't be able to check their Yelp to see if that's the food they're going to eat is good or not.
Right.
Kind of doubling back down on the volunteer programs. A couple of things that I think are interesting too is the National Weather Service's Skywarn program, and I think that's something that if you're in an area that doesn't really fit, but like in Maine specifically, weather is always an issue, especially with some of the winter storms and whatnot, that Skywarn might be one of those. And then with the fire watch, or fire corps, one of the things that we use them for in Orange County, California, is to do weather spotting during our Santa Ana wind times or other areas when we think that there's a high fire danger. And it's kind of like the old fire rangers that you think of in the 1950s when they're on top of those towers. But instead of doing that, they put them out in vehicles over into the areas, over the high areas, to watch for smoke so we can get on those things early. So there are other opportunities for people to be involved. And I think one of the things that we really need to stress, we're talking to our partners in emergency management, is how do we make the programs that people want to get into, how do we make it to where they feel valued? Because I think a lot of times with CERT programs that they don't feel valued as a member of that team, because the professional, quote-unquote, emergency manager, or not emergency manager, but the professional responders don't value them. I think there's a culture shift that we have to do, both as our trained responders with our volunteer responders. And then when I say volunteer responders, I'm not even talking about volunteer fire departments, because in my mind, they're more professional in most places than a typical volunteer. But the spontaneous volunteers, the plumbers, the carpenters that during a disaster can come out and help, I think we need to do a better job of articulating to them that they are needed.
Yes, definitely. And you mentioned the Skywarn. We utilize that here. My group of folks who are trained in Skywarn are my amateur radio guys. We have a RACES team, Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service team here, about 16, 17 members. And they just love the whole reporting the weather. They'll set up their own weather nets, and they're in touch with the Weather Service. They're very involved with that piece. We're fortunate or unfortunate, I guess, depending on how you look at it. We have zero professional firefighters in our county.
Wow.
All our fire departments are based at the municipal level, and they're all volunteer, 100%. So we don't have too much of an issue with them kind of looking down on other volunteers. The downside that we have is sometimes it can be very, very difficult to even round up some volunteer firefighters. We have had instances for a single-story, 1,000-square-foot house, residence, of calling out 16 or 17 fire departments to get 16 or 17 firefighters in the middle of the day. So we have a huge issue with that.
That does sound like a challenge.
So we don't have a problem with them looking down on them. We have a problem trying to find them most of the time. Hmm. They may not work in town. They may work elsewhere. A lot of our towns don't have any business or industries. They're just bedroom communities. And so you might be a half an hour drive away from your home, when a call comes in. And so many times their employers won't even let them go.
It's a noticeable problem, not just where you're at, finding volunteer firefighters, but Connecticut has a new recruitment program out of getting people to become volunteer firefighters. And I think there's an issue associated with, or two things, I think. One is, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, I forget exactly when the book came out, Robert Putnam wrote a book called Bullying Alone. And the premise of the book is that, this generation, the generation, the baby boom generation, if you will, maybe born in the 1950s, 1960s, they're not interested or weren't interested in joining. I think it was the counter culture, if you will, that they didn't want to do what their fathers did. They weren't joining the American Legion. They weren't joining the critter clubs. They weren't joining the bowling leagues. And so Robert Putnam created this book called, wrote this book called Bowling Alone. And it kind of points out that stuff. And then to top that off, I also think that we have culture now, even in seems like it's even in Maine, to where we're expecting the government to do certain things that in the past we didn't expect them to do. And so much so, you know, you talk about the power going out. People here in California, you know, if you're not having services brought to your door, they start to feel disenfranchised, if you will, and go to the city council and start to complain that this isn't being done. And so the days of your, of helping yourself, I think, is starting to, really pay a toll on volunteerism in general, regarding disasters and emergencies.
Oh, yeah. Our programs are so poorly funded, especially at the municipal level, that when I was a municipal director, I actually had someone come to me and say, well, you know, I'm paying for you. I said, you know how much money I'm getting a year? I'm getting $150 a year to be your emergency management director. If you want a full-time emergency management director, it's going to cost a little bit more than that. They don't realize that they're getting the government they pay for in some cases, which is nothing.
Yeah.
And there's a different level of expectations in the rural areas. Around here, they don't expect the cops to show up for 20, 30 minutes. They don't expect the fire department to be there for 15, 20, 30 minutes. Or I've listened to ambulance calls. It took an hour to get an ambulance to a residence because, except for the cops, everybody's volunteer. And because of the cops are not volunteer, we have so few of them that we have an 800 square mile county with 14 officers, that's in three shifts. There's only no more than three officers on duty at any given time. It's going to take a while for them to get there. And for us at this point, people kind of still expect that. But I see it down in southern Maine where it's much higher population density. They're expecting them to show up, you know, that before they hang up the phone, there should be somebody at the door.
This is so true.
What have you read, programs you've watched, or even someone that you look up to that that's in your field with your ideas on how to prepare the community? Can you give us any insight on that?
Well, one thing about emergency management is we steal from each other all the time. And I get a lot of stolen from me. we share everything. There is no copyright on anything we do. How I organize my local director meetings, I borrowed that from another county, my adjoining county. And we have an awards banquet for our local directors. And that was an idea that I saw that, another county was doing. The individual that did my job before me, my predecessor, ended up being a real good friend of mine, and he kept telling everybody that I was going to be his successor, and I kept telling him he was full of it. then he resigned. Next thing I know, I'm doing it. And so he was a mentor. We had a fellow, fellow named Robert Bowman, who was, we'd like to nickname the father of emergency management in the state of Maine. He was not only a huge leader here, and he was a county director, huge leader here in the state of Maine, but he was very involved with the International Association of Emergency Managers and spoke many times before Congress on emergency management. So he was kind of a huge mentor for us. When it comes to reading things, the last thing I read that I was very impressed with was William Fortune's One Second After. I read that just recently. As a matter of fact, one of my part-timers here just finished reading the book, and I liked it from the point of view of he really got into a lot of details about all the things that could possibly happen when you have a loss of power and electronics and all that. I actually know William Fortune. He taught at my high school.
Wow.
I didn't have him as a professor because I'd already had the class before he started. It was an ancient history class at Maine Central Institute. And he, after I had the class, he came in and was teaching there. And a bunch of my friends had him as a high school history teacher.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Huh. I actually got to interview William a couple times. He's a really great guy, and it's an awesome interview.
He used to come to his classes dressed up like a monk and sit Indian style on top of his desk. He built a ballista with his students. I mean, a huge one. Shot a javelin, like 10 feet long. They used to fire it on the football field.
Wow,
a very interesting character.
Sounds like it. Well, he's written quite a few books that are eye openers for a lot of people. His One Second After trilogy has really woken up a lot of people as to the threat of a total loss of electrical power. And it's one of the first books that I read that started me thinking about civil defense, because that's exactly what he did in that book. The character, that is, he developed a community civil defense organization, and it wasn't necessarily called that, but he had all the elements, and of course, it was successful because, you know, that's the design of a book. But it's also a model of what every community can do, not necessarily after the fact, because they had the perfect situation there because it was a novel. But in every community, you know, everybody, if you prepare before, then you don't have to scramble and try and catch up. Because as we know, disasters are come as you are. They're not come as you wish you were. So that's a major aspect of my mission of spreading the word about civil defense. And I thank you very much.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Oh, and another great book is Mike Mabee's book, the Civil Defense book.
Yes.
I was actually doing an online search for whole community preparedness, and his book came up. And I ordered a copy and got it, and then I got in touch with him, and we've met several times now.
Yes, Michael is a great guy. Matter of fact, Todd, you've interviewed him twice, right, or just once?
Just once.
Okay. All right. I finally got to meet him in person in December at the InfraGuard EMP Summit, and that was really great having an opportunity to meet him in person. We've talked on the phone many times, and I read his first book, and then his updated book came out as the civil defense book. And
So I've got his original one too.
Yeah. I failed to bring my book out to have him sign it. It was in my briefcase, but I never got around to it. So I still got to get him to sign my book. But Dale, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. And I hope we can get you back again sometime soon.
Okay, great.
Any last words, Todd?
Hey, Dale, thank you for a great conversation, and let's keep in touch.
Yes, thank you.